It's our happy privilege now to open the Holy Scriptures together, and if you have a Bible, I invite you to join me in the first chapter of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament. And I want to read from Ecclesiastes chapter 1, reading the first 9 verses. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh under the sun? One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about to the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The thing that hath been, it is that which shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun. I'm sure you can tell this morning from this reading that this book is very philosophical in nature. It is actually part of what is described as the wisdom literature of the Old Testament. There are 3 books that comprise what Bible students call the wisdom literature of the Old Testament: the book of Proverbs, which contains short vignettes or wise sayings, post-it notes for living life, if you please, Proverbs. The book of Job is part of the wisdom literature of the Old Testament. It discusses the philosophical question, why do people suffer? And particularly, why do God's people suffer? And that is certainly a subject that each of us are familiar with in our own experience, because we've all suffered, right? So Proverbs, Job, and then Ecclesiastes addresses the philosophical question, what is the meaning and the purpose of life? It's a book of wisdom, then, targeting that particular issue: does life have significance? Now, this is God's perspective on wisdom. You may know that the world's wisdom is personified by Rodin's famous sculpture, The Thinker. You've seen that sculpture. That's a picture of the world's wisdom. But biblical wisdom is personified by the Holy Spirit, may I say, not in terms of the thinker, but by the preacher, as you see in verse 1 of our text, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And the question he's asking again in this book is, does life have meaning? Why am I here? What is the purpose of my existence? Is life significant? Those are questions that each of us probably has asked ourselves at one point or another in our lives, particularly if you've ever been through the dark valley of affliction. When trouble comes, we begin to ask, what is the meaning of it all? What's it all about, Alfie? Viktor Frankl wrote a celebrated account of his experiences in a Nazi concentration camp entitled Man's Search for Meaning. I spent a good bit of yesterday reading that account again. Frankl was a Jewish psychiatrist living in Austria when Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich came to power, and when the Jews in Austria were rounded up and taken to the concentration camps. Viktor Frankl and his wife, his mother, father, brother, and sister were among the Jews who were transported via train to Auschwitz and Dachau and other concentration camps. Frankl spent 3 years at Auschwitz. And while there, he was stripped of his modesty. He describes in vivid detail the emotional shock of being disrobed and shaven from head to toe and treated like animals. He was stripped of his modesty. He was stripped of every earthly possession. And he lived every day under the very real prospect that he would be the next one sent to the gas ovens. And like every other prisoner, Frankl tells his story that he suffered intense starvation. He ate a 5-ounce piece of bread every 4 days when he first arrived. That's the only food that he had. And he suffered frostbite from regular exposure to the bitterly cold temperatures without adequate clothing. In fact, many of the prisoners had no shoes at all. They were forced to work in the snow in Germany. Frankl tells this story concerning the regular brutality and inhumane treatment to which he was subjected together with all of his fellow prisoners by the Nazi guards. Upon his release from Auschwitz, he learned that his father and his mother, his brother and his wife had all perished at the hands of the Nazis. Only his sister and he had survived the nightmarish ordeal. And it was while he was there that Frankl realized he was brought face to face with the most basic questions of life. Is life worth living? Does it have meaning? Is there any reason to go on? Does life, with all of its misery and heartaches and disappointments and unhappiness, have any ultimate purpose? He describes 3 stages that every prisoner goes through. As a trained psychiatrist, he was taught to analyze life situations in terms of his discipline, and he describes these 3 stages. He said initially every prisoner faces what he would call the stage of shock, stunned by the immodesty and the inhumane treatment and afraid to look at anything or anybody in the eye. And he says first is the stage of shock, and that, he says, soon turns to apathy, where you reach the point that you just don't care anymore. You reach the point because the sufferings are so tremendous that you almost wish for death. You're not afraid of the gas chambers any longer because you see it as a possible solution to the misery that you're presently in. And he says this stage of apathy goes on for the bulk of your experience. And then he says after you're released, he says you face bitterness and disillusionment. He talks about one man who was one of his chief comrades and companions while he was in Auschwitz, who was a very gentle soul, but he said after they were released, he said, the first Nazi that I find, some blood is going to be spilled today. And he said, you're a better man than that. He says, you shouldn't get revenge. And the man was just eaten up with bitterness and anger and disillusionment at what he had experienced for those many years. So he describes these 3 stages, shock, apathy, and then bitterness and disillusionment as they tried to assimilate once more into life. It was through this painful ordeal that Viktor Frankl discovered the central theme of what would become his life focus as a therapist and professor of psychiatry. It was simply this: he learned that survival in the worst of life's conditions depends on the ability to find meaning and purpose, even in the sufferings of life. Listen to this quote from his book. He said, in the Nazi concentration camps, one could have witnessed that those who knew that there was a task waiting for them to fulfill were most apt to survive. The people that were most apt to survive were those who had something to look forward to. Listen to what he said. As for myself, when I was taken to the concentration camp of Auschwitz, a manuscript of mine ready for publication was confiscated. He had hid this in his coat for a while, but it was soon discovered and taken. This manuscript, he said, was confiscated. Certainly, my deep concern to write this manuscript anew helped me to survive the rigors of the camp. He said, I tried to reconstruct it. For instance, when I fell ill with typhus fever, I jotted down on little scraps of paper many notes intended to enable me to rewrite the manuscript, should I live to a day of liberation. I am sure that this reconstruction of my lost manuscript in the dark barracks of a Bavarian concentration camp assisted me in overcoming the danger of collapse. The point, again, is that survival depends on the ability to find meaning, even in the midst of life suffering. Solomon, the preacher in our text, we know that this was most likely Solomon because it describes him in verse 1 as the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And certainly Solomon is the man who most accurately fits that description. Furthermore, he says, verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And of course, Solomon was the last king to reign over both Israel and Judah. Israel in Jerusalem, Israel and Judah separated after Solomon's reign, and they had their own kings, but while he was in Jerusalem, he still reigned over Israel. So I think we're safe to say that Solomon is the author of this book, and certainly he was beyond anyone else in a position to have experienced all of the things he's going to describe in the second chapter. But Solomon would have resonated with Viktor Frankl's search for purpose and significance in a world that's so predisposed to unhappiness and depression. Did you know, even if you and I never suffer at the level as Frankl did, yet scarcely a day passes in our lives in which there's not ample reason to be unhappy. Isn't that true? As you think about your life, don't you have a number of things that cause you stress? Of course, I haven't been beaten with the butt of a gun by a Nazi guard. I haven't been stripped of all of my earthly possessions and made to stand exposed to God and man and to the gaze of all the world. I haven't suffered the kind of inhumanities that Viktor Frankl did, but yet each of us has ample reason in our lives to say life is hard. Think about the dysfunctional relationships that you've experienced. Maybe you grew up in a home where your father and your mother fought and didn't get along very well, or perhaps you've had sibling rivalry that you've dealt with all of your life. The dysfunctional relationships. Maybe some of you have suffered the breakup of a marriage or a friendship. Think about the unkind things people have said about you in your life. Of course, that happens in each of our lives. You haven't lived very long before you get wind that someone has made a statement that has a barb on it. It hurts you. And you say, I just don't understand. What did I do to make an enemy in this situation? Think about your unfulfilled dreams. You know, I'm in my mid-50s at the moment, and I have to tell you that my life hasn't turned out exactly like I thought it would. When I was young and optimistic, I foresaw a life of success and prosperity and good health and great relationships, but I have to tell you that it's been a fight and a battle and a struggle all along the way. Isn't that realistic in your life as well, dear friends? Now, we could preach a Hallmark sermon or a guidepost sermon this morning that's designed to sort of brush the surface and help us to feel good about ourselves, but the Bible deals with reality. That's why I love the book of Ecclesiastes. It's very hard-hitting. It's very realistic. And if you're like me, I deal with reality better than I do with idealism or with fantasy. And here's a book in which Solomon said, I can understand why Frankl was struggling to find meaning, because even though I haven't suffered like he has, I have suffered enough in my life to know that I've wondered, is there any purpose to it all? What's the meaning of it? Why am I here? Am I making any difference? Am I just going to be a headstone when it's all said and done, with a date of birth and a date of death and a little dash in the middle, remembered by just a few? But yet the world as a whole keeps going at 90 to nothing in spite of my passing. These are hard questions. They're the ultimate philosophical questions of humanity. You think about the unfulfilled dreams that you've had. You think about the fact that you've been overlooked, perhaps, for the recognition that you think you deserve. Maybe you've been passed over for a promotion at work. Maybe you've struggled for a long time making the same wage when others have gotten promotions and you say, my wage hasn't kept up with the cost of living. You think about the daily frustrations that we all have when appliances go on the blink. And you say, why is life so hard? Or tires become flat and you have to spend time and effort to change it, or suddenly you have a tickle in your throat and you have to go to the doctor and get some medicine in order to recover your health. Sigmund Freud talked about the fact that life is hard. In these terms, he speaks of the everyday unhappiness of normal human experience. Now I wonder if normal human experience has to be unhappy. Of course, early on in our lives, before we've had some problems, the least little thing can rush us off of our feet. But I dare say it's a hard thing to learn to find meaning even in the midst of the disappointments and the afflictions and the sufferings of life. And Ecclesiastes begins on this pessimistic, or perhaps we should say realistic, note when he says, the words of the preacher, vanity of vanities. Now, this book is a sermon. That's why he calls himself the preacher. It's a sermon preached to a young audience, an audience of young people. You say, how do you know that, Brother Mike? I know it's a sermon because he calls himself the preacher. It's a homily. And I know it's preached to young auditors. If you look at chapter 11, verse 9, he addresses his audience by saying, rejoice, O young man, in thy youth. He's speaking directly to young people. Here is Solomon in his later years. Jewish tradition says that Solomon wrote the Song of Solomon when he was young. He wrote Proverbs in midlife, and he wrote Ecclesiastes near the end of his life as an experienced, older, mature man. And here's an elderly gentleman now sharing his years of experience with some young people. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth. And wouldn't it be wonderful if we could learn by just listening to the wisdom of our elders? Most of us have to repeat the same mistakes, it seems like. But it would be wiser if we could just listen to their advice, get the message without having to go down the same course. Solomon is telling his young audience that I've already been through life. I'm nearing the end now. And may I share with you the benefit of my wisdom and experience. And he says, here's what I want you to do, O young man, rejoice in your youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth. What's he admonishing or counseling his young auditors to do in this verse? He's saying, enjoy your life. Let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart and in the sight of thine eyes. But he adds this check and balance, but know this. Be careful before you sow too many wild oats. But know this, young people, listen to this, that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. So it's not wrong to enjoy your youth. It's not wrong to enjoy your life. But you need to understand that God is going to hold you accountable for what you do. Then in chapter 12, he says, remember now thy creator in the days of what? Thy youth. He's talking to young people. So this is a sermon to a young audience, in which he shares his personal experience. For 10 chapters here, he gives his own insights, his own experience. He tells what he's done, what he's accumulated, and he talks about his search, his quest for significance and meaning in life. And of course, a sermon has to have a text. And what is his text? Verse 2 of chapter 1, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, all is vanity and vexation of the spirit. Now, we don't have a marquee in front of our church building that lists next Sunday's sermon topic. I've seen some churches that have those. But if we did, and I were to advertise that my sermon next Sunday would be on this thought, all is vanity and vexation of the spirit, how many people do you think would be intrigued by that and say, I'm coming to church there next Sunday? And if I were to say I'm going to preach on the mark of the beast, or on how to get rich quick. I'm sure a lot of people would be interested in that. But if I were to say I'm going to preach on the futility of life, most people would say, no, thank you, I'm depressed enough. I don't need to come to church to get more depressed. But that is Solomon's text here. Vanity of vanities. Now, interestingly, this word vanity is one of the key words of the book. It's used some 38 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. And of course, when we think of vanity, most of us think of pride, don't we? Some of the older folks in our congregation know that a mirror and a dressing table and maybe a bathroom were once called a vanity. And still, it's called that because people spend an awful lot of time looking and admiring themselves in the mirror. But when the Bible uses the word vanity, it's not talking about what we would call pride or an egocentric, narcissistic approach to my own importance. The Bible word vanity literally means futility. You ever done something that's futile or in vain? With the advance of technology, most of us have at least worked on a computer, if not owned your own personal computer. And if you're like me, you've typed a good bit, you've written a number of articles and even lengthier essays and projects. My children have written research papers. I've written a number of chapters for books and so forth on the computer. And there have been a few occasions in which I had failed to save my work before there was a power surge and the screen went black. And this was before the programs were designed to save in the event of an unexpected crash, to save the material. And a few times I've perhaps worked for several hours and then come back and I thought, all of that work is futile, it's all in vain. Have you ever done something that was in vain? And you know the sense of outrage of that. Why did I beat my head against a brick wall? The wall hasn't moved and now my head is sore. And many people have that perspective when they think about their lives. Especially as you get older and you start looking back and you think, it's been a fight from the get-go. I've had one problem after another. I've been trying to keep my head above water while I'm being rushed off of my feet by a strong undertow. And you think, why am I doing this? Why am I getting up and going to work every day? And just doing the same thing, the monotony of life over and over and over again. It all seems to be senseless and meaningless. That is exactly what Solomon says. I want to talk to you young people about. He says, all is vanity, vanity of vanities. The word vanity then means emptiness, meaninglessness. The Hebrew word hevel speaks of what we might call a vapor or a fog or breath. And really the idea is what is left after a bubble bursts. Something fleeting and temporary. Every child I've known loves two things. Candy and soap bubbles. By the way, that's the secret to parenting if you haven't figured it out. If you really want to be able to handle your kids, buy them candy. And go down to the dollar store and buy them a little container of soap bubbles that you can blow in the air, because that will keep them entertained for hours, won't it? Now, here's the picture of vanity, a soap bubble. As you blow the soap bubble and the little child runs after it and he tries to grasp it, but what happens? It's there and then it's gone, right? It's empty. It's futile. It leaves no lasting mark. There's no evidence that was ever there in the first place. That's the thought. In this word, hevel, which means vapor or fog, it's the same thought in James 4:14 when James says, what is your life? Now there's a philosophical question for you. You ever ask that? What is my life? He says, it is even a vapor that appears for a little while and then it vanishes away, like the morning mist or fog. As soon as the sun breaks the horizon, the fog dissipates. And that's how fleeting, how temporary, how ultimately meaningless our lives seem to be. Maybe you're about this time saying, Brother Mike, this is pretty depressing. I was sort of depressed already when I came to church, and now you're just digging the hole a little deeper, and you're making me more depressed than stick with me. But we have to see this dark background before we can appreciate the jewel, the gem. You ever noticed how a jeweler displays a diamond in his jewelry case? He doesn't just set it on the counter, but he puts it against a black velvet backdrop, or maybe a crimson or red background, because it's against the contrast of the dark color that the brilliance of the gem shines forth brightly. And even so, my beloved, before we can truly appreciate and understand the rich truth of Scripture, we have to see the reality of struggle and tension and difficulty. We have to understand that there is a sense in which life is like blowing soap bubbles, and it leaves no lasting impact. And notice, if you're not already depressed enough, Solomon gives us another reason to be depressed, for he elevates this thought of vanity to the superlative degree. He says, vanity of vanities. Now, that's a Hebrew literary form that is designed to express, again, the superlative degree. You know, in the Old Testament tabernacle and temple, there was a place called the holy place. Then the innermost court was called the holy of holies, right? That is, of all the holy places, this is the holiest of all. It's the superlative degree. The Bible has been called the book of books. Libraries are full of volumes, but here is the best book that's ever been written, my friends. It's the only book by divine inspiration. It's the book of books. Jesus is called the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. You see, that's the superlative degree. He's the King's King. Above every potentate, he's the sovereign one. He's the King of the Kings, the Lord of the Lords. This is the book of books. And Solomon says, vanity of vanities. He's saying this is ultimate meaninglessness. This is ultimate despair. And this is about as cynical and as pessimistic a tone as you and I will ever encounter in life. You say, Brother Mike, why is this book so depressing? Because nothing is more depressing in our lives than the thought that we've lived in vain. Do you remember when Abraham Lincoln gave his Gettysburg Address? One of the lines that has been immortalized from that brief yet brilliant address was the line that these young men have not died in vain. That is, that their life and their death counted for something, that it wasn't just all a waste. It wasn't just all meaningless. It wasn't just all empty. So Lincoln says there's a purpose for it. And of course, how can you deal with the death of a young man or young person if it seems to be senseless and there's no rhyme nor reason? Lincoln knew that he was very psychologically astute when he said that, I want you to realize that the cause for which they fought was worthy, and their lives were not spent in vain. Well, my friends, have you ever wondered, am I living in vain? What am I doing here? Am I just taking up space? Am I just a tree that cumbers the ground, producing no fruit? Is my life significant? Does it count for anything? Or am I just like a hamster in a wheel, going in circles, just going through the motions, but yet making no lasting impact? Solomon's sermon, may I say, dear friends, is ultimately harsh because it forces us to face that question. Tommy Nelson, a pastor in Texas, summarizes the thought of vanity. He said, by vanity, Solomon means that you live for 60 or maybe 70 years and then you're gone. Someone gives away all your possessions, and the things that really mattered to you are sold for $1 each at a garage sale. Life just doesn't seem to have any natural reward of itself. It doesn't automatically head to a climactic point of happiness and meaning and fruition. It just grinds on and on with the sun rising and the sun setting. Nature never rewards you. Instead, it smashes you into pulp. Then you die and you're placed in the ground. All of your possessions that nobody wants end up in a garbage bag. In that sense, he says, man is a vapor and life is vain. A generation comes and goes and you are forgotten as if you never existed. Here's another poem by Matthew Arnold called Rugby Chapel. Maybe you've heard this. He said, most men eddy about. Here and there they eat and drink, they chatter and love and hate. They gather and squander, they're raised aloft, and then they're hurled in the dust, striving blindly, achieving nothing, and then they die. That's the tone of despair that Solomon is describing when he says, vanity of vanity, all is vanity. This pessimistic attitude toward life is the product of living life without God factored into the picture. Look at verse 3. What profit hath a man? He says, what good is it? What gain have you experienced? What profit hath a man of all his labor which he taketh? Here's the key phrase of the book. Under the sun. Under the sun. Now don't lose me now, because here's where we turn the corner. That phrase, under the sun or under heaven, appears some 30 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. And it's the key to interpreting his message here. What Solomon is saying is, when you look at life without factoring God into the picture. By the way, where is God? Is he under the sun? No, God's above the sun. He's beyond the sunset, as we sang this morning, right? God is in heaven, but under the sun is an expression that speaks of a strictly secular, this world only perspective and approach to life, as if God does not exist, without any consideration of transcendence. He says, when you look at life without factoring God into the equation, then you're left with this attitude of pessimism and despair that it doesn't matter. Now, what's the flip side of that coin? If you factor God into the equation, life is supremely meaningful. There's purpose. There's meaning. There's significance. There's joy. There's happiness. But without God, there's no sense. You can't make any sense of it. In fact, without God, he says, the whole world seems to be operating like a machine. Look at verse 4. One generation passes away and another comes, but the earth abideth forever. What he's saying here is, you're born, you live, then you die, but the world just keeps on going. It never misses a beat, as if you were never here for the most part. Now, I know that when I'm gone, there will be some people who mourn my passing. There may be some people who are glad and celebrate, but I'm sure there will be loved ones, family, who shed a tear and who have trouble adjusting to life in the wake of my absence and who miss me and who long for reunion. But did you know, beyond just a little two-paragraph write-up in the local newspaper on Section C, page 4, the world at large will never know that Michael Goins was ever here, much less gone. So, Brother Goins, I just don't like to think about that. I like to think that I'm a VIP, that I'm important. The fact is, though, one generation comes, another goes, but the world continues forever. It just keeps going, doesn't it? And that's one of the things that's so difficult when you've lost a loved one, you're bereaved. Your life has experienced this traumatic change, and you think, doesn't anybody care? Because beyond the funeral service and the gathering of family and friends and the memorial and the for the next few weeks, the phone calls and so forth, it's not long before the rest of the world picks back up with its regular pace while you're left to try to scramble to gather the pieces of life and to keep going forward. The world seems to be mechanistic, like a machine then. You can almost hear the sound of the gears grinding. As he says, the sun also riseth and the sun goes down. And then it hastes to the place where it arose. It just happens again. Now, you're speaking in the layman's terms. Don't use verses like this to say that the Bible is not meteorologically accurate. The Bible is not written as a scientific textbook, my friends. It's written from the perspective of the common man, and as far as we're concerned, it appears the sun rises, then it travels its circuit to the other horizon, then it sets, and then in a little while it's hasted back to the place where it came from in the first place. It's a cycle. The wind goes toward the south, and then it turns about to the north, and it whirls about continually. Notice he's using the circle in these verses as the model, the emblem of what life looks like when you don't consider God is there, without factoring God into the equation. He says, all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Do you know why the sea's not full? Because the water that's there evaporates, goes back to the clouds, right? So the rivers run into the sea, but at the same time the water is evaporating under the place from whence the rivers came, thither they return again. So there's a cycle. This circular or cyclical approach to interpreting life in the world is the perspective of secularism or a this world only kind of philosophy. We see the world as a machine, and everything in history seems to be operating in this aimless and meaningless circle. By the way, the Bible view of history is not a circle. Do you know what it is? It's a straight line. It's a linear perspective that has a particular beginning point and it moves toward a conclusion. And what is that conclusion? The conclusion is that Jesus Christ will win. And he will put down all opposition. Every foe will be vanquished. Isn't it wonderful to know, dear friends, that redemptive history began in the mind and purpose of God in the covenant of grace, and it will have a certain climactic conclusion whenever all the elect are conformed to the image of Jesus Christ in that upper and better world. Won't it be wonderful there? I'm glad to believe that life is not just a circle, but we are moving toward a conclusion. Okay, notice that when you have this cyclical view of life, the only option that remains to you and me when we're looking for meaning under the sun is that nothing works out. There's a tone of despair, therefore. Solomon says, I kept looking. I looked everywhere. And I want you to notice how that in verses 9 through 11, Solomon responds to this unrelenting pursuit for meaning under the sun by saying that man will never be successful because there's nothing new. He says, that which hath been is that which shall be. Now, we tend to look down on the past as people who are ignorant, but I'm telling you, dear friends, even though some of the trappings of life may have changed, still the things that people are trying today to find purpose in their life are things that have already been tried. Somebody says, okay, well, let's escape. Let's escape to the pill bottle. Let's escape to the liquor cabinet. Let's escape to the beach or to the mountains. Let's take a vacation. This will bring happiness. This will bring the joy and the purpose that I've been looking for. Solomon says, I've tried it all. I've tried it all. Look at this. In chapter 1, verse 12, he says, I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. He says, I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. So he's looking for purpose in knowledge, in education, in learning. And I love verse 14 where he says, I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. That phrase literally means chasing the wind. I want you to think about that for a minute. Vanity means what is left after a bubble bursts. Under the sun is a key phrase. It speaks of life without consideration of the God who's above the sun. Just trying to find purpose in this world without any thought of God, living like a practical atheist. And this phrase, vexation of the spirit, means chasing the wind. I coached a Little League baseball team or a Dixie youth baseball team for several years when my kids were small. And I'll never forget the frustration of looking out of the dugout at little Johnny playing right field. And little Johnny had taken his glove off and it was laying on the ground, and he was turning circles out there, reaching his arm up to the sky, trying to grab who knows what. And he was catching imaginary fly balls is what he was doing. But I remember saying, "Johnny, watch the game. Johnny, you're going to miss the ball. You know, you're playing right field, but the ball is going to be hit to you and eventually, and you need to be ready, Johnny." And I'll never forget how little Johnny was out there catching imaginary fly balls. He was grasping for the wind. That's the phrase Solomon uses here when he talks about how people are seeking for meaning in everything in this world except the only place that it can truly come from, which is fellowship with God. He says they're just chasing the wind. They're trying to grasp the wind. Have you ever tried to hold oil in your hand? Is it easy to grasp? No, it slips through your fingers. I'll tell you, as hard as it is to hold oil, it's even more difficult to grasp and to hold the wind. Can you seize the wind? Air, my friends, is not very tangible. Here's the thought. People are out there chasing fulfillment in their marriages, in their jobs, in money, in their physical attributes. Somebody says, "This is what it's all about. I'm going to the gym all the time, and look at me, I'm a specimen of attractiveness. Look at my muscles, look at my posture, look at my beauty." By the way, may I say there's nothing wrong in and of itself with exercise, but if you make a god out of your body, you're going to be disappointed, and it won't be long. I was so proud of my athletic prowess as a teenager. I could play free safety on the football team. I could intercept passes. I could run on a state qualifying 4x100 meter relay team. And I thought, this is who I am. This is who I am. I'll have to tell you, my friends, that those days are long past. The old gray mare, she ain't what she used to be. It doesn't take long before you realize I can't do what, and it doesn't take long before the beauty of youth fades. Isn't that right? It fades, and you say, I'm looking pretty rough. I'm looking pretty rough. Solomon says, "I've sought meaning in all of these things. I sought it in education and learning." He says, "I've come to great estate. I've gotten more wisdom than all they which have been before me in Jerusalem." Here he uses the word wisdom not in terms of divine wisdom, but in terms of the wisdom that can be gleaned from this world. "Yea, my heart had great experience of wisdom and knowledge." What he's saying is, I thought that going to school would satisfy the deep need in me to find meaning in my life. Now, there's nothing wrong with education, nothing wrong with reading, nothing wrong, my friends, with learning and growing in your knowledge base. Each of us should seek to use our brains as much as we can, for God has given us our minds. But Solomon says, "I want you to know in much wisdom is much grief. And he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow." This is as close as the Bible will ever get to the old adage that ignorance is bliss. Because the more you know, the more you sorrow at what you see happening around you. So he says, "I sought for fulfillment in knowledge," but he said it was like chasing the wind. Then in chapter 2, he says, "I sought for meaning in pleasure. I said in my heart, I will prove thee with mirth. Therefore enjoy pleasure, and behold, this also is vanity." What's he saying? He's saying that I tried leisure, entertainment, recreation. I tried to just say, this is what life is. Life is a beach. So play hard. Life is short. Play hard. That was my philosophy for a while. I tried knowledge. Life is knowledge. He says that turned out to be anticlimactic. Unfulfilling. I tried pleasure. That didn't work. And then he says, I tried material possessions. Chapter 2, verse 4. I made great works. I built houses. I planted me vineyards. I made gardens and orchards. I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. I made pools of water to water the woods that bringeth forth the trees. I got servants and maidens. You talk about wealth. You talk about things, you talk about material possessions. He says, I accumulated everything. And of course, Solomon was in a position to do that. You talk about riches. This man had them. You say, oh, if I just had more money, I think I could be happy. That's where the meaning is, in wealth. Somebody says, in pleasure, being able to go on vacations to Italy or to South America or to Alaska, or that's where. There's nothing wrong with vacations. There's nothing wrong with building houses. That's not what we're saying this morning. There's nothing wrong with learning and knowledge. I'm just saying that if you don't factor God into the equation of life, it will all end in meaninglessness and frustration and emptiness and despair. This search for meaning under the sun inevitably leads to abject despair. Peggy Noonan, who was the former speechwriter for Presidents Reagan and Bush, wrote this in a 1992 issue of Forbes magazine. She says, I think we've lost the knowledge that happiness is overrated. In a way, life is overrated. We have lost somehow a sense of mystery about us, about our purpose, our meaning, our role. She says, our ancestors believed in two worlds. And they understood this one to be the solitary, poor, nasty, and brutish, and short one. We're the first generations of man, and of course, Solomon tells us in Ecclesiastes that she's not exactly accurate there. But she says, we're the first generation of people that actually expected to find happiness here on earth. No, we're not the first. There's nothing new under the sun. There have been other people who've tried it. But here's what she says, and our search for it has caused such unhappiness. Isn't that right? She says, we're so earthbound. We're so focused on the here and now. She says, the reason is, if you do not believe in another higher world, if you believe only in the flat material world around you, if you believe that this is your only chance at happiness, if that's what you believe, then you won't be disappointed when the world does not give you a good measure of its riches. You will despair. You will lose hope. You will be utterly depressed. If you think that this is all that there is, here's the thought. Apart from God, the quest for meaning and significance in life is a mirage. It's an optical illusion. It's a pipe dream. You say, preacher, then, is life futile? Is it empty? Is it vain? I want you to notice that the book of Ecclesiastes does not end on this pessimistic note. Turn to the 12th chapter. He says, remember your Creator, you young people, while you're young, in the days of thy youth, before the evil days come. You say, what are the evil days here? They're the days when your enthusiasm for life will be lessened, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. You know, it's a burden every day you get up. While the sun or the light or the moon or the stars be not darkened, that means when your eyesight fails and you can't see as well as you once could. He says, when the keepers of the house shall tremble, you'll get the shakes. You won't be able to write as clearly and legibly as you did when you were young. He says, when the strong men shall bow themselves, the men that were once robust and full of vim, vigor, and vitality now are leaned over, being pulled back to the dust from whence they came. He says, and the grinders cease because they're few, your teeth start to fall out. The dentist has to pull more and more and replace them with implants or with partials. And those that look out the windows be darkened. You just can't quite see like you once could. He says, and the doors shall be shut in the street. That means you won't have the opportunity for employment. The doors are shut in your face. You know, nobody wants you. You're not marketable. You're too old. When the sound of the grinding is low, you can't hear anymore. These are the evil days. What he's describing here is what we would call mature years or old age. He says, so while you're young, you remember what it's all about. Because when you get old, it's going to be more challenging, more difficult. Listen to this. Also, you'll be afraid of that which is high. Would you climb that ladder? Oh, no, I'm not getting up there. And no, I don't want to fall. You know, that could be the end of me if I took a fall. He says, the grasshopper shall be a burden. You're more concerned about an insect in your garden than you are what's happening in North Korea on the other side of the world. The grasshopper's a burden. And the desire shall fail. That is just the enthusiasm for life and for pleasure and for partnership. He says, because man is going to his long home. When the silver cord will be loose, the golden bowl will be broken, then the dust shall return to the earth from whence it came. Listen now. Vanity of vanity, saith the preacher. All is vanity, and moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. You say, what's the use? What's the use in preaching? What's the use in reading the Bible? What's the use in trying to teach people what it means and what it says? What is the use? This is supremely meaningful, dear friends, because this is the only thing that matters. It's the only thing that lasts. Do you remember Mr. O'Hara's famous line to Scarlett about the red earth of Terra? When he said, the earth, the land is the only thing that matters. The land is the only thing that lasts. This world is all that there is. Mr. O'Hara was wrong. He was wrong. Because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people. He still, in spite of people saying, what you're doing is worthless, meaningless. You folks that have skipped the golf course or the lake to go to church this morning, you're really wasting your lives. He says, no, this is what really matters. Because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yea, he sought to find out acceptable words, and what was written, that which was written was upright. So he just preached the word. The words of the wise, he says, are as goads and as nails fastened by the masters of assemblies, which are given from one shepherd. The good shepherd has given us this word. Now we try to fasten them into the minds and hearts of God's people. And further, by these, my son, be admonished. For making many books, he says, there's no end of that. And much studies of weariness of the flesh. Therefore, make sure you become a master in this book. By these, be admonished. By these principles and precepts, watch this. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. This sermon and this book of Ecclesiastes and Solomon's homily, you say, what does it all boil down to? Let's crystallize it. Let's distill it down to the bottom line. Here it is. This is what I've been saying to young people, Solomon says. Here's what life's all about. Fear God and keep His commandments. You put Him first. You live your life in the light of His reality, that He is there, that He exists. You seek to serve Him. You do what He says, even if you don't understand it. You ask His blessing upon every part of your life. Did you know with God factored into the equation, work, education, recreation, relationships, material possessions, it is all supremely meaningful when you factor God into the equation of life. When viewed in the light of God, life makes sense. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Life's purpose is to enjoy every day as God's gift. Seven times in this book, Solomon says, therefore, there's nothing better than for a man, and he means a woman too, to enjoy the fruit of their labor. It's not wrong to work and enjoy it. It's not wrong to enjoy a beautiful song on the radio, to read an interesting book, to see the beauty of the sunset, to catch a big bass, to paint a lovely portrait, to watch your grandchild play baseball, to hold a little baby on your lap, and to train and nurture that child as they develop toward adulthood. It's not wrong to enjoy life as long as you do it in the light of God's presence. God's glory is the goal. Beyond the sun, all of life is significant. Futility turns to purpose, chasing the wind to pursuing Christ. Despair changes to hope and happiness. Let me close with this verse, 1 Corinthians 15:58. After he talks about the resurrection, Paul says, therefore, what is the resurrection? That there's more to life than just the here and now, right? There's a life after this life. After he talks about it, he says, therefore, in the light of this, my beloved brethren. Notice he addresses them pastorally because he loves them. My beloved brethren, therefore, be ye steadfast. You keep standing like Viktor Frankl in the nightmare of Auschwitz. Be ye steadfast, unmovable, always abounding, keeping on, keeping on, always abounding in the work of the Lord. For as much as you know, here's something we can be sure of, that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. All is vain without the Lord, but in the Lord, your labor is not worthless, it's not meaningless, it is supremely significant. This, my friends, is true wisdom. It's not the thinker, it's the preacher who still taught the people knowledge.